Hey y'all, it's your old pal Opie Hendrix, and you're tuned in to KPFT, Houston's 90.1 FM.
Looking out a dirty old window, down below the cars in the city go rushing by. I sit here alone and I wonder why.
Welcome to Growing Up in America here on KPFT Pacifica Radio. It's Claire Dutre and Dr. Bob. Claire, how you doing?
I am well. The sun is out, so I can't complain.
I wanted to do, before I talk about what's going to be on the show, I wanted to do a little debrief yesterday.
Well, the elections, complain.
Right? I mean, we really should have Jason Sabo joining us. But yeah. What are you thinking about? I mean, you and I were very interested in those seats of the Republicans who were against vouchers, right? Mm-hmm. The governor really campaigned hard against them.
Yeah.
He was relatively successful, though not as successful as he would have wanted to be.
Yeah, it is. It's worrisome to see those seats lost on a national scale. It's exciting to see some Dems win in other states. But I've been saying, I know a lot of the frustration this morning in staff meetings was, where were the women turning out, especially with looming women's rights being restricted? But I think, one, people don't really do their research, so they could be voting for women, and then those women are super conservative without knowing. And there's a lot of burnout, especially, this is what worries me, and I hope that it gets people revved up for the next bigger election, so that they understand that people have burnout. I mean, I sent you a lot on what people are feeling about Biden administration. Yeah. And so, yeah, I'm worried about the presidential election and, of course,
and politics. How young people vote, right? You and I are always very concerned about how young people vote.
That young people vote.
Yeah, that they show up. Exactly.
Yeah, it's still important, I promise, especially in the House and Senate and state level elections, big state person.
Yeah, and to hear people say, why should I vote for someone bad even though the other one is far worse? Well, that's why you vote for, you know, if you consider the person.
And there's a balance of power. And so you have other seats you can vote in, and there's a state versus national politics. And so it's not just one leader that we're voting for, and they don't have ultimate authority across everything, or we hope that that's never the case.
Well, we'll keep our eye on some of the runoffs as well in the state in regards to vouchers, and I think that'd be a good topic for a future show as well, just to talk about that a little bit. On the show today, here on Growing Up in America, Dr. Jamie Freeney is going to be with us, our favorite mental health advocate. She's going to be talking a little bit about community violence and the impact with parents, right? So that should be interesting. Blake Marlowe, buddy of yours, is with the Texas Legislative Education Equity Coalition. That's a mouthful.
TLEEC.
So is that what they say? TLEEC?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So with TLEEC. So we're going to be talking with Blake a little bit about public education and curriculum censorship. Did you see that big report on 60 Minutes over the weekend about banning of books? I'm sort of interested.
We can talk about that.
Yeah, we can. Caitlin Newell will be with us. She is with the Early Childhood Education Coalition. We're going to be talking about prenatal to three collaborative. And then, of course, we'll have Renuka Rege is on, and she's with Texas Appleseed out of Austin.
Great lineup.
Talking about reimagining school discipline. This is like a heavy hitters here today.
I know. It's like my dream lineup.
Your dream lineup.
This is my starting baseball
so
team.
This is good. Thumbs up, thumbs down. After the break, we're going to be talking about, should kids have the opportunity to participate in, who's going to be against mock voting, Claire?
I think a younger Claire shouldn't have done mock elections, but we could talk about that.
Oh, man. I'd love to talk about, after the break, we're going to talk about, should we be doing mock elections in the schools, and how good are they? I'll answer that. They're not usually very good, but they're good in terms of getting kids to think about voting, right?
Yeah.
So I think that's going to be an important thing. After the break, and Rico's on the what do you call
DJ
it?
Booth?
DJ booth.
I don't know.
You have some good tunes for us, Rico, for this little quick break? All right, take it away. ¶¶ All right, we're back. Thumbs up, thumbs down today. Mock elections in the schools. Good idea, bad idea. Now, you grew up in Louisiana, so like everyone was in the mock elections, they were voting like their parents, right? That's what we see a lot of times. And so you did a lot of Republican voting as probably in some of those mock elections, Claire.
Yeah, don't give me a ballot in these mock elections in middle school. But I think it was interesting. This is why I'm always open to opportunities that take learning outside of a textbook and really have application. This had a lot of bias. We had one student in my class do Obama. Everyone else did go red. I did Rand Paul. So I apologize. I did not.
I did not
vote that way when it comes to voting.
You're a kid. You're allowed to make mistakes.
I know, but it didn't feel. It felt more. It wasn't given good parameters, and so it was more attacking. It wasn't information driven. So I think when done right, they can be pretty interesting. But when done wrong, it does just institute group bias on the students.
Yeah, but you know, it's high school. I mean, group bias is sort of your middle name in high school, right? I think that's what...
Especially now, in small towns.
Believe it or not, I was not a group bias sort of kid. And, you know, I did the Communist Party lineup in high school.
In
so I think that... I remember one of my first mock elections and Gerald Ford won, but I did not vote for Gerald Ford, of course. So it's sort of an interesting... I think it's a good exercise in sort of civic engagement. So when your social studies teacher inevitably is the one running this and they say we're going to do mock election, I think it's a good idea. And people get to make little speeches.
Well, mine was the football coach / civics teacher, but needed the civic spot to the coach. He was great. He was wonderful. I think it's also it would have been cool to see an example ballot. Ours was more campaign for a year person. Yeah. And talk more on what else is on the ballot, not just the presidential election.
Mock elections could be better, but I'm saying thumbs up.
Put Prop 2 on your ballot. You can vote as a kid for Prop 2.
Oh, wow. I think this is good stuff, though. I think the whole idea of experiential learning in school is something we don't probably
explore
do enough of, right?
Yeah.
And we need, in terms of civic engagement, probably an important thing. We know right now that there are forces in the state that don't want kids to sort of go out and vote. And, you know, there's a law in Texas, this is interesting, that kids should be encouraged to register before they leave high school.
Mm-hmm.
And there are people actively working to make sure that that does not happen.
And trying to raise the voting age up. That's why when you say who would be thumbs down this, I can think of a few teachers that'd be worried to even hold it, because if it gets too progressive, it might be the next headline.
One of the thumbs up, thumbs down we might do in the future is I wrote an op-ed, I'm going to say 5 years ago, saying kids 12 and up should be allowed to vote.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because we know how incorrectly so many kids vote, you know, in these mock elections. Would that happen if they were voting for real? Would they vote like their parents? Probably most would.
Yeah.
But it would at least give that voice to children and maybe to children's issues, right? So interesting little deal. All right. Coming up on the program, we're going to be talking to our good buddy, Dr. Jamie Freeney. She's going to be here to talk a little bit about neighborhood violence, parents' impact. We'll be right back. Go Rico. Yes. On the line with us is Dr. Jamie Freeney. She's the director of the Center for School Behavioral Health at Mental Health America and our resident mental health expert. Dr. Freeney, how are you doing today?
I'm wonderful. How are you?
We're super good. We're super good. And Claire and I are even better when you're on the line with us, Jamie.
Of course.
So.
As well.
Hey, Dr. Freeney. I was so excited to see you on the lineup and excited to talk a little bit today about community violence and the impact that parents have. Before, can you give general overscope on Mental Health America and the view in Houston?
Absolutely. So Mental Health America of Greater Houston is a professional development, education, policy, advocacy, and connection organization. We primarily focus on access for all to the mental and emotional and behavioral health supports that are needed. And we have various departments. My department focuses on children and adolescents. And we also have a veterans, integrated behavioral health, mental health literacy, and policy programs that are all focused on supporting the mental and emotional health of Houstonians.
Dr. Freeney, talk a little bit about community violence and its impact on kids and then subsequently on parents. What, I mean, we know it's not good, but mentally and, you know, how much trauma does it, is it providing or is it giving kids?
Absolutely. So, community violence really happens everywhere, but it's more concentrated in particular neighborhoods. Oftentimes, these neighborhoods are disadvantaged and may have issues that are more so connected to historical lens. So, just where they're built, how they're built, and the concentration of people that are there. And so, when you have a neighborhood that is predominantly, I guess, held by those that have, you know, poverty rates of 30% and 40%, those that really, you know, may not have a lot of fresh foods, a lot of places to play.
Yeah.
Those are the types of neighborhoods that we often see increased violence in, and not only violence to people, but violence to property, break-ins, aggravated assaults, car break-ins, things like that. And so when children are around that, it is impacting how they view the world, and also it's impacting their brain. Truly, their brain is still developing, and so when we talk about, oh, it impacts the brain, it's true. Like, that's a fact. It impacts how the brain is developing, and more specifically, the amygdala and the areas that are used as our stress response system, and the areas that are used to signal a threat and help us to keep ourselves safe or put us in survival mode. And so when children are exposed to violence in their community, it really can shape the way they start to think about survival and they start to think about their own safety. Mm-hmm. And so when we are talking about community violence, not only is it seeing something happen, but it could also be hearing shots, hearing gunshots, knowing or finding out, you know, the next day that a neighbor was murdered down the street. So even they may not necessarily see it, but it's still impacting them because of they know that it's there. And once a person knows there's a threat, then our bodies naturally help us to try to be, you know, to look out for it and to fight back. And so, unfortunately, this long time exposure can really cause children to develop where their body thinks it's normal to be in such a vigilant state all the time.
Yeah. And Dr. Freeney, just as you were saying, I go back to being a teacher and similar sentiments my friend shared whenever there would be lockdown, not a drill, but a actual situation. I saw a lot of the students react very normally, and that might just be the state of America, but also, even in high stress situations at the school or around the school, there wouldn't be as heavy as a response or receptive that I would think from the students in that situation. When it gets to a point of a certain age, what is something we can do to support these children from birth to career, but also when they're in their high school age years and they're not responding because of the violence they had to come impact with?
So, So can you kind of expand on what you're saying, not responding to...
Yeah, just when they've experienced community violence throughout their life and they're at the age of high school or even middle school. And so these responses may already be heavily impacted. What are ways that school systems or just communities can support those children?
And parents, right?
And parents,
what,
yeah.
What can the parents' reaction be?
Yes. So there's a couple things you hit on. One is the school... when school violence and school shootings and things like that, I have to say that the way that some schools are preparing kids for an active shooter, so utilize these active shooter drills,
yeah,
are traumatizing to youth. There are other ways that we can prepare our young people in how to maintain safety than actually having an active shooter drill.
Yeah.
Another point to what you were saying is in helping children to overcome what they've experienced in their community is really relationships. And relationships equal, not all the time, but relationships should equal safety. Mm-hmm. So what the American Psychological Association just put out released a article that talks about the community violence and amygdala reactivity and the protective role of parents and teachers and really adults. And so what we know is that those children who are exposed to community violence have a better chance of overcoming and being able to process that that violence appropriately if they have a present parent or a loved one, a teacher, community member that can nurture them and provide them with the opposite of what they're seeing and what they're hearing. So it really does change the way the brain reacts and starts to form because of that constant love and protection and nurturing. And if we really think about it, when we are exposed to war, violence, whatever it is, we want to know, we have to think about, okay, am I safe right now? And adults, we can say, okay, well, as of right now, we're safe. We're not in the midst of war. We're not in a war zone, thankfully. But if we were to be, we would be looking for community. We will be looking for interactions with other people because it helps us to feel safer. It helps us to feel better. Our anxiety would reduce if we're together. So if we're thinking about children and that trusting relationship has a huge impact on how they view things because it's helping their brains to understand, okay, you might see violence, but you're still safe. Yeah. You're still under the watch of a parent. And it's that constant reminder of being safe, that constant feeling of love, and also knowing that there's someone out there that can, that I can go to. And so that when they looked at children in this particular study who had that close relationship with an adult or with their parent, they saw that the amygdala, that part of their brain that responds to stress, was stronger and was developed more normally so that they were able to process better when stressful things happen. They don't react as wildly. They don't, kind of lose their minds or what have you. Yeah.
It's interesting, right? Because you will have a certain percent of the population that will say, hey, this stuff happens, just sort of suck it up, pull yourself up, this is what happens in our neighborhood, you just need to be sort of immune to it and toughen up. When indeed, what this study is saying is the complete opposite, which is loving and tenderness and taking care and showing that you appreciate them is really the thing that's going to heal the children much more than the, say, toughen up approach.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely,
yeah. Yeah. I think, and parents sort of need to understand that, right? I mean, I think we have in Texas, right, we have parents who are like, oh, no, you need to toughen up. When indeed, what kids need is that sort of reassurance and the TLC, right? The thing that we know kids love, right?
And it's really interesting very quickly here. Parents are often the product of a household who told them to toughen up.
Yeah.
So they're
yeah.
only doing what they know. But we have to recognize that that's not helpful, and we have to be the ones to stop that cycle.
Yeah.
So while we can say, yes, you know, toughen up and be strong, we also know that there are these other factors that are more important than a child being tough or strong.
Yeah, and you hear parents, right, that say, well, it happened to me, I toughened through it, and I'm okay. And right. the response needs to be, Are you okay?
Well, and what I say to that, Bob, is because I talk about generational trauma a lot,
yeah.
and what I hear is people saying, well, my parents beat me and I'm fine,
yeah.
and, you know, or I turned out good. And what I remind them is that no, you turned out not because they beat you. You turned out good despite the
right.
fact that you got spanked or that you were abused.
Yeah.
You turned out. So it's not because of. It's despite of. And I think that's a very wow. crucial key in our language as we are, you know, recalling our own histories and how we were able to overcome and be resilient. It's not because of the abuse and the slavery and the neglect. It's despite all of that and our innate power to overcome struggles and obstacles and our community and our organizations like Children at Risk, who provide opportunities for education and safety
yeah.
and honest conversations around this.
You know, it's the unfortunate reality that we have community violence, but we need to know how to deal with it. Parents need to know how to deal with it. So Dr. Jamie Freeney, our Mental Health America expert, thank you very much, Jamie. As always, we love having you on.
Yes,
we want
Dr.
You to...
Bikini and Dr. Sanborn, thank you for continuing this conversation and for allowing, yeah, inviting me to come and talk. I always have such a great time with
Alrighty.
You.
Take care, awesome. Jamie. Bye-bye. Next up on the program, Blake Marlowe is with us. He's with the Texas Legislative Education Equity Coalition. We're going to be talking about marginalized communities and sort of the impact on critical thinking of some of these new curriculum censorship laws that have been in the books. And we'll be right back with Blake Marlowe here on Growing Up in America.
Baby, keep it real with these people. Baby, like a preacher. Baby, probably still say a roof. Baby, putting on for the city. Baby, you the realest. Baby, probably got a couple million. Baby, having 4 or 5 killers. Baby, got children. Baby, probably still a drug dealer. Baby, having a trap for your rapper. Baby, making plastic. Baby, in the hood, can't act. Baby, keep it real with these people. Baby, like a preacher. Baby, probably still say a roof. Baby, putting on for the city. Baby, you the realest. Baby, probably got a couple million. Baby, having 4 or 5 killers. Baby, got children.
We are back on Growing Up in America. And always good to talk to Dr. Freeney, don't you think?
It is.
Yeah.
What an expert.
She's
and, of course, myself.
She's got it going on. Blake Marlowe is with us. He is with the Texas Legislative Education Equity Coalition, or
TLEAC.
TLEAC. And he's one of the facilitators there. Blake, how are you doing today, ma'am?
I'm doing well, thank you. How are you?
Very, very good.
Good.
Talk to us a little bit about curriculum censorship and what's going on with public education right now, Blake, and some of the work that you're doing around that.
Yes, absolutely. So just to kind of restate your introduction, I am an affiliate member of TLEAC, Texas Legislative Education Equity Coalition, and I'm a facilitator of our working group on DEI and censorship policy. And so TLEAC in general is an advocacy organization that focuses on improving educational outcomes with a focus specifically on racial equity.
Yeah.
And so what our working group has looked at is some of the recent bills and standing legislation and how those bills and legislation has been implemented throughout Texas, specifically as it relates to censorship, SB3 from the 87th legislature, and then HB 1605, which was passed during this most recent legislative session.
So talk to us about this. I mean, is this related to some of the book bannings that we've seen? And we see a lot of curriculum censorship that seems to be geared towards authors and curriculum for students of color, but certainly a lot of LGBTQ sort of curriculum. I mean, talk to us about what you're talking about right here, Blake.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think it really kind of boils down to kind of a multi-pronged attack on education
yeah.
at the K-12 level. So you mentioning books, one, I guess, mechanism that the legislature has tried to use is introducing parental reviews. So parents can challenge books in school libraries. They can also ask for reviews of curriculum. And that review of curriculum was just introduced by HB 1605, which I mentioned earlier. And so it's a mechanism there, and it can be used for good, but you could probably guess it's been really implemented.
Exactly.
So that parents can do the opposite, right? Because when you look at what books have been challenged, right, most challenged books tend to be books that deal with topics like sex and sexuality, right, that highlight or discuss race and ethnicity and kind of grapple with those difficult questions that parents maybe don't want to have those conversations right at home, and certain sections of the community don't want children asking those questions and discussing those things in our schools. It's unfortunate, but that is one side of things. The other side is really attacking how we teach our students history. There's a big focus on trying to eliminate discussions of race and sex in our social studies classrooms, as well as eliminating any type of discussion of sexual health in our classrooms that doesn't deal with abstinence specifically.
Mm.
Yeah, and then Blake, I know we talk a little bit about this, but for our listeners, we've seen a lot more of a chilling effect when we look at higher education and the dissolving of DEI departments or departments that students really rely on that created a sense of community for them on campus. Can you speak a little bit about that and what this kind of chilling effect looks like on that level and in K-12 with these book bans?
Absolutely, Claire. So you're referencing SB 17 also passed during this last session. And that one, as you already mentioned, banned DEI offices. Now, this one is interesting because we see this tactic used a lot by not just the legislature in Texas, but we've seen this replicated across the country in state legislatures where they use very vague language in these laws. And so it's kind of intended to create this culture of fear. And as TLEAK and other organizations that do similar work have had discussions with students, with faculty on these campuses, the kind of top two things we hear from them is that there's a great deal of confusion about what this impacts. And there's a lot of fear of being held to account or being found in violation of the law because they have this lack of guidance. So to give a quick overview of SB 17, it bans DEI offices. Campuses can no longer require trainings on race, ethnicity, sex and sexuality. They can't have any policies that explicitly reference race, sex, sexuality. But things like teaching, curriculum, research, student organization activities, the speakers they bring onto campus, those things are not supposed to be touched. But we're hearing a lot of stories coming out from universities. With this only being in place in effect for about 2 months now, where we're already hearing stories of student organizations having to rename or rebrand or being denied funding or access to university resources because they are a racially focused or ethnically organized group. So things that are kind of in violation of the law, but there's a lot of confusion of among these people, among the faculty and students, where they're not really sure, like, oh, are my rights being violated or is this permissible under SB 17? So,
Blake, what is the...
All that said, just this culture of fear.
What is the long-term impact of all of this, Blake? I mean, we know that the majority of our student body in the state of Texas, K-12, are students of color, right? We know that the growing number are low-income kids. But we also know that this could have an impact on intellectual curiosity. But what is your biggest worry, 10 years down the road, 5 years down the road, that the impact that these laws could have on our K-12 system?
Yeah, K-12, I think the biggest thing is I think it's a campaign to kind of homogenize, assimilate a growing population, as you've already referenced, mm-hmm. of students that don't look like Texas in the past, right?
Yeah.
We know that Texas is becoming more black, more brown. The majority of people who are moving into Texas, who are being born in Texas, are not white, right? They come from groups that do not identify as white. And so you have a very vocal, and at this point, from a political standpoint, a very overrepresented minority of people who are trying to do just about everything in their power to fight that, right? They don't want to have those discussions of race and sex because they see a state that's changing, that's becoming more diverse, more inclusive, and hopefully more equitable, and those are the exact things that they are trying to fight against. So my fear is with all of these censorship efforts, right, 10 years down the line, and I think they really kind of lay out well, the state does, in this law, in HB 1605, they talk about wanting to teach students to be patriotic and to have, like, a sense of patriotism for their country and their state. But really what I see that as is indoctrination, right? You can learn all about your state or your country's history, the good and the bad, and still feel pride in your country,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You can say, hey, I love my country no matter what, good and bad, right? I'm willing to work with that and hopefully improve things in the future, right? That's what kind of motivates us to become engaged in politics and in government. But when we have a system where students are, I love my country, are saying, I love my country because it's the best, that's problematic because we're just giving them one side of the story.
Right.
And the other thing is that if we're saying that we want kids to be more patriotic, and that means racism is more patriotic, you know, you go to the Valley, let's say, you know, which is, you know, 90% Latino, you'd be hard pressed to find a more patriotic place. But if we start equating being patriotic with some of these racist focused laws, you're gonna lose the impact of patriotism, right? I mean, it's just a sort of a stupid deal, isn't it? Yeah. So overall, so
absolutely. Yeah. And I think just to kind of touch on that point very briefly, myself growing up, so I'm not originally from Texas, I'm from Wisconsin. And growing up, Wisconsin, Milwaukee, where I grew up, is very racially segregated in terms of neighborhoods. So majority of African-Americans live on one side of town, so on and so forth. And growing up, African-American side of town, generally lower income, and then surrounding areas that tended to be whiter, a little bit wealthier. And so growing up in that environment, not knowing the history of the city, there's a lot of questions of, like, you know, why is it that people who look like me tend to be poor, struggling, make up the majority of folks who are on the streets or need social services? And if I don't know my American history, if I don't know the history of slavery, if I don't know the history of economic disenfranchisement of black people being kept out of the labor force, I might look within and say, wow, there must be something wrong with my community, because America is a place of opportunity. Everyone has an equal shot, so there must be something wrong with us. And I think that that's very problematic if our students are taught this, you know, this kind of mythos of America being and always having been this place of equal opportunity, and then dealing with the realities of where they see themselves and their communities.
Yeah.
Blake Marlowe is with the Texas Legislative Education Equity Coalition, or TLEEC. And Blake, thank you so much for being on Growing Up in America today. Such insight. And I look forward to having Blake come back, Claire.
I know, especially with the next session.
Yeah, very good. Thank you, Blake. And we'll be right back with more on Growing Up in America. Coming up, we have Caitlin Newell. We're going to be talking about the first 3 years of child's life, early childhood education, prenatal to three. We'll be right back on Growing Up in America. All right. Rika, are you playing the same song over and over? Because it sort of has that same little, like, it drops to the beat, you know.
Rika Bob does not know house music.
But I love it. I love it, right? And Rico knows I love this music. So it just doesn't mean I can't tease Rico a little bit. Caitlin Newell's with us. She is the Associate Director of Early Childhood Education at Children at Risk and part of the Prenatal to Three Collaborative, the PN3. Caitlin, how's the weather in Austin today, Caitlin?
The weather in Austin is lovely today. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Is this your first time on the Growing Up in America radio show, Caitlin?
I think this is my second time, and
second.
I will apologize. I am getting over a cold.
So oh, we don't hear it.
For any coughing or sneezing.
No, we don't
we'll
hear
just
it
cut
at
you
all.
Off the air as soon.
So give us an idea. Give us an idea, Caitlin. How important are the first 3 years of life for a child?
Well, I think we're all aware the early years of childhood have a profound impact on a child's lifelong health and well-being. And from the prenatal stage to age three, we know from research that this is a critical time for brain development. that, again, is really the foundation for that child's lifelong learning, their success, their physical health, their mental health. And all of those things, of course, have immense ramifications for the future of our state. These are our future leaders, our future workforce. And so the Texas Prenatal Literacy Collaborative, our job is to work with community stakeholders, families and parents, and with state leaders to advance smart policies that enhance efforts to ensure that Texas infants, toddlers, and their families are off to the strongest start possible.
Yeah. What is three, or if it's too long, maybe one issue that you're continuously hearing from parents in the community that falls or seems like it's falling on deaf ears when it comes to our policymakers?
Well, yeah, that can sometimes be a long list. The Prenatal Three Collaborative really, through a bunch of listening sessions with families, with communities, have chunked our work into three big pillars that we think are critically important. The first is healthy beginnings, so making sure that infants and their parents and the women who are giving birth have that healthy beginning in that perinatal period. The second is early care and education. Families need to be able to access high-quality care that is accessible, affordable, and provides rich learning experiences to support children's early brain development. That is a huge issue that we hear a lot about. And then the last is family supports. So in addition to kind of that early medical care, early care intervention, we hear a lot from families about the suite of supportive programming that families need in order to thrive, including things like evidence-based home visiting in those first weeks or months of life, or early childhood intervention for children who are born with complex medical diagnoses or developmental needs.
Caitlin, if we were looking at sort of the perfect way to raise children in Texas, and let's say parents were doing everything right and their families were doing everything right, and we could talk about that, but if the state, on the other hand, was doing everything right as well, and here we are in a state in Texas where it's a working state, so most likely a parent is going to be working and they're going to need this super high quality childcare. What would public policy be like in our state if we were doing everything to make sure a child were successful in regards to childcare?
I think one of the things that I hope that we as a state can really internalize is that investing in children now through investments in subsidizing childcare or making sure that these programs are well-funded and well-resourced is an immediate investment, to your point, in the Texas workforce. All of these children are attached to adults who need to go to work, who need to know that their child is safe and thriving. So it's an immediate investment in our current workforce and our current economy. And equally importantly, if not more importantly, it is an investment in our long-term economy. It's an investment in the workforce of tomorrow that has immense ROI. There's a plethora of research that indicates that investing in this early phase is hugely good for society and reaps huge economic benefits.
Yeah. I know, Caitlin, as we see different bills pop up across the nation in different states as it relates to maternal health, there's kind of a worrisome looming across, especially in southern states. Have you heard any of this echoed from the mothers or expecting mothers in these collaboratives of what it might mean for their access to health care or what it might mean for their pregnancy when they deliver?
Absolutely. It's a recurrent theme that we keep hearing, that anxiety around what maternal health care will look like, how people get care. During some of the listening sessions, we heard from some parents and providers that women were having trouble even connecting with a health care provider because for one reason or other, they may not have gotten early prenatal care, they may have moved and were trying to change care providers and weren't able to find an OB who was comfortable accepting them into their practice if they, after a certain week of pregnancy, after, they're several months along. which is quite distressing because we want women to get prenatal care as early as possible, but whenever they come, we want to make sure that people are getting the care that they need. It's a very difficult landscape. There just aren't enough providers. There's this intense anxiety about what maternal health care will look like. I will say a bright spot, the Prenatal to Three Collaborative was crucial in supporting the passage of HB 12, which extended Medicaid coverage to women 12 months postpartum.
Yep.
So that is a huge win for women and babies across the state, making sure that these babies have healthy moms in that first year after they're born. And so while there is this intense anxiety, I also want to make sure that people know that there are these places where we are having a collective impact, things are changing, and there's hopeful progress as well.
And I think it's interesting too, right? I mean, we talk about the needs in Texas, but frankly, for a red state in regards to working to make early education, childcare better, at least in Texas, we're trying, right? I think as a red state, we see some things happening that wouldn't be happening in other red states. I'm not saying, Caitlin, we're anywhere near where we need to be, but at least we have sort of bipartisan support of the idea of early education. When you think about that, right, are there things that we could capitalize on to continue the move forward sort of maybe in the next session in the short term?
I think one of the things that I'm really interested in through this interim period and leading up to the next session is talking with community members about how they can educate their electeds about the child care needs in their own communities. I think that's, A, it's hugely impactful. B, we know that child care, like many different care industries, it can be hugely regional, that we have vast childcare deserts, particularly in rural areas across the state, that those elected officials may not understand kind of the depth of need and the potential for truly a collapse in this really vital foundational care economy that undergirds their workforce. And so I think that's always my biggest push is that if you are in a place where you know this is an issue for your community, getting in touch early and often now during the interim while your chosen representatives are home in their districts is a great opportunity to help them understand what the needs are in that specific community, what potential solutions could look like, and help make sure that everyone's voices are heard.
Caitlin, let me ask you one last question, and it may be unfair, but you know what type of questions I like to ask. And so when you look around the state at early education and you look at some of the child care centers, the daycare centers that are all around our state, those that serve low-income kids, those that provide subsidies, is there one? I mean, there are probably a handful that we think are sort of top of the line, but which one comes to mind for you that they're doing unusually good things for kids, knowing that it may be one of many, but which one would you pick, Caitlin, to highlight today?
I don't know if there's any one in particular that's easy to highlight, partly because our state is just so vast.
Yeah.
And there are just some great providers. I think an organization that provides kind of a large repertoire of services that I am continually impressed by is Avance.
Very good.
Yeah, they're two-generation focused both on early childhood education and also in engaging in really meaningful and transformative ways with parents as well is very inspiring. But there are many, many really dedicated early care and education professionals across the state who are striving every day to serve their communities, often foregoing their own compensation in various ways. And so to highlight just one, I think, does a disservice to all of those who are laboring.
You know what I'd like to do, Caitlin? I would love for you to point out to Claire and I at some point, you and the team, right, some of the best places in Houston. And I would like to visit them and then maybe bring their directors onto the radio show and to sort of talk about some of these best practices. And, you know, you and I, Claire, were talking about this whole idea of experiential learning, but this could be a good thing. And, you know, people like to hear some of the, what are the best places and what's going on there. So anyway, Caitlin Newell, out of the PN3 Coalition, Children at Risk, out of Austin. Caitlin, thank you very much for all the work you and the team do, and we look forward to having you back one more time on Growing Up in America.
Thank you so much.
All righty, take care. Hey, coming up for our final guest here on Growing Up in America, we're going to Texas Appleseed. Renuka Rege is with us. She's going to be talking a little bit about reimagining school discipline. We'll be right back with Texas Appleseed here on Growing Up in America. Back on Growing Up in America. Claire, how you doing?
I am so well. I'm excited to talk about reimagining school discipline as a past teacher.
Renuka Rege is the policy advisor with Texas Appleseed. They do great work, Texas Appleseed over in Austin. Renuka, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So talk a little bit about the work that you're doing around reimagining school discipline, which is a big concern to me personally, right? I mean, it's inequitable in Texas and it's all over the place. Talk a little bit about what you guys are doing.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we have school discipline here in Texas is really laid out both in state law, but also by their individual districts. And so there is a part of the Texas Education Code, Chapter 37, that really lays the framework. And coming up in 2025 is the 30th anniversary of Chapter 37. And so we think at Texas Appleseed that it is really good time to take a hard look at how it's working and really dive in and make some changes because we know that, unfortunately, school discipline is disproportionately impacting students of color and students with disabilities. And when kids are not in school, they're not learning. And we think that this is a great time to take a look at just really evaluate the data, look at our policies, and make some changes this upcoming year in 2025.
Yeah, Renuka was part of a really powerful community event where we gave some data on in-school, out-of-school suspensions, as well as DAEP and JJEP placements, and found that almost 100% of the placements were at-risk or economically disadvantaged youth. Assuming that those programs are 30 years old, I can only imagine that they weren't reformative. And especially hearing from my own students that went to DAEP placements, they came back almost more discouraged. And I would love to hear what Texas Appleseed has in some exemplary programs that are really helping students and engaging them with counselors rather than from what my students said, quote, it felt like a prison system.
Oh, yeah. And I'm so glad you asked that question because DIEPs is one of the areas that we really want to focus on. But, you know, one shining example that really stands out to me is in Dallas ISD. They have an initiative called the Reset Centers. And these are, there's a space within the school building where they have an environment where when a child may be having a situation, may be having a bad day, they can go there. And they can speak with counselors or trained professionals to try to, you know, process their emotions that they're feeling or deal with whatever situation that they're dealing with, have someone to really talk about it with before it really escalates into some sort of behavioral situation. And so I think Dallas ISD has been seeing some really great results with those reset centers. And so they've really been reducing their suspensions. And that's definitely an example that I would highlight in our state.
And that's important, right, that we have examples of what really works as opposed to people saying we've always done it this way. And and what could we do? I mean, what should be sort of the starting premise for any superintendent who takes over a district or any principal who takes over a school? What should they be thinking about in terms of school discipline and thinking about differently, Renuka?
Absolutely. It's a great question. So what I would say is it's really important to keep in mind that these are all children, and their brains are still developing. They're still learning how to think before they act. They're still learning how to process their emotions and not let that, you know, not let that dictate their immediate actions. Even high schoolers, right? They are still kids who are developing in that way. And so we have to remember that, you know, and school is a place where they're spending most of their time. And so this is a place where not only they're learning academic skills, but they really are learning social skills, emotional skills, and how to be part of a community, how to interact with others productively. And so I think that that's really important to keep in mind for leaders who are taking over. And obviously they know that. But sometimes it can get lost when there's some sort of big situation, like a disagreement that blows up, for example, between two kids or between a staff member and a kid. And I know it can be very stressful, but I think just we have to keep in mind, like we are the adults. And they are children, and so we have better control over our actions, and we have to create the conditions that can allow kids to succeed the most, because we know, and the research is clear that when kids are out of school for discipline, then they're just going to become disengaged and have worse outcomes down the line. So we have to do everything we can to try to keep them in school.
Yeah. Renuka, I want to talk a little bit, and I'm not sure how much of this intersection you see on district of innovation. I know in HISD and their recent passing of the what they're going to do under district innovation, it included ruling out that vaping is an immediate DAP placement. Have you seen that district of innovation allow schools to reimagine school discipline, or have you seen more of a the opposite effect?
That's a great question. So this is actually the first law that I have really heard of districts using their District of Innovation plan in order to opt out of that type of zero tolerance law. This law being that recently, you know, last legislative session, there was a bill passed that a kid having a vape would be automatically that they would be placed in a DAP. And yes, HISD did opt out of that, and several other districts around the state have actually chosen to opt out of that with their District of Innovation plan because they don't want to take a zero tolerance approach and they want to evaluate each child's case or each child's situation and see if they need, you know, they might need a second chance or they might just need some education on the issue. But they didn't think DAP was the right response. And so this is actually the first law that I've really seen that be widely used. But it is a very interesting research project. I think that we do need to dig in a little bit deeper into the District of Innovation plans and see if any districts are using this creatively around discipline.
Renuka, you're in a tough job, right? When we talk about reimagining school discipline in Texas, it's like it's so counterintuitive to what so many Texans believe, right? I mean, it's we live in a state where we're quick to try children as adults if they do something horrendous, even though any expert would tell you, well, their mind really wasn't developed. I'm not sure that they're ready for adult prison. But it just doesn't feel right to not say, oh, I agree, they should be tried as adult. And the idea of removing kids from the classroom, well, if they're disruptive, they have to be removed from the classroom, even though it's bad for that kid, right? I mean, it's sort of a hard place to be in for you guys because there's so much nuance and subtlety and so much science too backing you up, right?
Absolutely. It is a very tough place to be in, but what I've found is that, you know, the people who have like the most tough on crime mindset, the most zero tolerance mindset, as soon as they personally know somebody who has gone through the DAP process or who has been, you know, expelled or something like that, then most of the time they change their mind because they see how harmful this can be to a child. And they, and most Texans actually, if we had recently, Texas Appleseed had done a survey around like juvenile justice issues, which is, you know, it's related to school discipline, and most Texans believe that kids should get a second chance.
Mm-hmm.
And they shouldn't be automatically locked up, and they should stay within their community, which includes school. And so, I think that part of it is telling the stories of kids and what actually happens when they get tied up in these systems, including the school discipline system. Because what we've heard is that, you know, once somebody actually knows somebody who's been through it, they realize there is no due process.
Yeah.
Oftentimes the parents and student are not heard, and they just see how harmful it is to be out of school for so long.
Yeah.
And so that's part of the message that we have to spread. A lot of the times people don't really get influenced by research and data, but it's the stories of people that they know that actually helps to convince people.
Renu, guys, we run out of time. We always like to do a couple of fun questions, so we'll have to make them super brief. What did you want to be when you wanted to grow up, Renuka?
Oh, that's a great question. Oh my gosh, I can't even remember. But I will say that I was always like interested in helping people and trying to make the world a better place.
Look
and
at that.
So I don't know. Yeah, and so I feel grateful that I kind of ended up in that place, or hopefully I'm trying. So.
A helping person.
Yeah.
Right? So.
And then the last question is, what song energizes you for a hard task?
Oh, energizer song, Renuka. What do you have?
Oh my gosh, these are hard questions. I mean, I will have to say that probably anything by Beyonce is very energizing, mm-hmm. and I know she has some new things that are more in the countryside, and I am not complaining about it. I she's so talented, and everything she does is energizing. So,
wow.
Yeah, that's what I'll say.
Where did you grow up, Renuka? Where was it that you grew up?
I grew up here in Houston.
Oh, look at that! I'm
in Houston now, even though I work at Texas Appleseed. I'm in Houston.
Oh,
so.
Wow! Very good.
Mm-hmm.
Renuka Rege is our expert on school discipline. Renuka, you need to come back to the show. We love having you on. So we'll look forward to seeing you soon. And that's it for us on Growing Up in America. We do this each and every week
for children.
We'll see you next time, Growing Up in America.
With a dream, my cardigan. Welcome to the land of fame, excess. Am I gonna fit in? Jumped in the cab, here I am for the first time. Look to my right and I see the Hollywood sign. This is all so crazy. Everybody seems so famous. My tummy's turning and I'm feeling kinda homesick. Too much pressure and I'm nervous. That's when the taxi man turned on the radio.
KPFT Artist Profile, Shelley King.
Well, KPFT embraced my album and played it regularly, and that really gave me a big boost up getting started, getting my name out there. Over the years, I've done some benefits and stuff, and it just feels like a family.
Listen for her music and other local artists right here on KPFT.
Oh, well, a young man ain't nothing in this world these days. I said a young man ain't nothing in this world these days. In the old days, when a young man was a strong man. All the people stand back when a young man walked by.